We left off with a little bit of a cliffhanger yesterday, or I left you with a thought question to try to address, that essentially we have bifurcated the major questions of the trade-off. The question the Gemara wants to address, is there a trade-off to be made in terms of sinning a little bit for a good end, so to speak, should we say, the ends justify the means? Or do we say that, no, there is no justification, that we won't let you do even a small aveira in order to avoid a larger aveira? And we have these two major tracks, the question of dealing with it for your own sake or dealing with it on behalf of someone else. So first we have to just finish off the question of, from your own end, why should there even be a suffix about this? I mean, it seems to be that from a mathematical point of view, if that was the only consideration, so what's there to talk about? It's clear that we dislike big averas more than we dislike small averas. So if you have the opportunity to trade in a smaller one for a bigger one, or the other way around, you know, trading a bigger one for a smaller one, for sure you should do that. Why
we're
is it?
We're talking about someone else's bigger.
So not yet, because it's two separate issues, right? So one, before they're going to eventually share a lot of common territory, but there's so many points within each one that we have to look at them a little bit separately. So first, just your own consideration. It's the fact that the Gemara is at first at least wondering.
And never answers.
Right. So the question is, but the assumption of the poskim is that it is permissible, with some qualifications, we'll talk about that, that you are allowed to take it out if you put it in. So the question is, from both sides, we started to discuss yesterday, on the other hand, on one hand, it seems pretty poshut that if you apply basic logic, basic math, why would anyone say not to do this? On the other hand, maybe there is what to ask so much so that it's not so clear why the impression that we have is that it is mutter. So yesterday we discussed how this contrasts with the Gemara Maseches Pesachim, where we saw that Hamidu Devrayhem B'Makom Kares, that Chazal, in some cases, did insist on adherence to their dinim, even when what was involved was a prohibition of kares. And we went through some of the differences between that sugya and this sugya. We had a little bit of a super synergy yesterday with yesterday's Daf Yomi, talking about the tshuva, the Binyan Shlomo, about that. So we went through some of those questions, and one of the important points that emerged, for example, if we took the view of Rabbi Akiva Eiger, in addressing that question of the difference between the Gemaras, this was a very important point, that Rabbi Akiva Eiger felt that there's no comparison between the Gemara and Pesachim and this Gemara, that in the Gemara and Pesachim was talking about the interplay between two different areas of halacha, two different mitzvos, that maybe Chazal said, listen, we're so worried about Chveis, Chol Shabbos, or something like that, that will tell you don't do hazah even to allow for the Korban Pesach, and that's a kares. So, okay, so maybe there is a svara to say that the concern of Shabbos is so strong that we insist on it even when it's going to obscure a different area of halacha, and there might be a mathematical surprise that it may not necessarily be totally on what kind of onshin we're talking about. That might not be the key factor, but at least you're dealing with different areas of halacha. But, as Rabbi Akiva Eiger, this Argamara, the reason it doesn't involve the same type of logic is because Argamara is talking about one Aveira, it's talking about Shabbos. So it really would be surprising if we say that when it comes to Shabbos, we'd rather you observe a Din D'Rabbanan at the expense of a Malacha. Because, in other words, what we wanted to extract from that Rabbi Akiva Eiger is that the Gemara maybe isn't saying the math is irrelevant, that there is the math isn't always the only determining factor. Sometimes when different areas of halacha clash with each other, so then, okay, so you might find that you're surprised by which one dominates. But within one, we should look to the math, and it doesn't really make sense to say that we should tell you to worry more about the Din D'Rabbanan than about the malacha itself. Now, that's not the only way to look at things, but it's an important part to put on the table that, again, clearly our assumption here is that whether the Havmin or the Maskana, but that nobody here is being irrational, and that there has to be some svara, there has to be some logic to it, why we would trade the Daraisa to the Darabanan. It has to be something that's going to make sense, and we have to address that element
why
as well.
Why wouldn't trade it?
We Well, right. Well, we would trade or we would trade either way. But you know, the question is that if we trade the observance of the Dereisa for the observance of the Drabbanan, if we prioritize observing the Drabbanan, there's got to be some logic to it. So that's also a part of it. One of the things to think about here is that it's fascinating that part of what may affect a man, and this is something that's just we'll put out here at the beginning because it could affect a lot of considerations, that you see that there is an assumption that a din derabanan kind of attaches itself to whatever issue it's addressing, and that violating that din derabanan is on some level as if you are violating the din deraisa. In other words, that if you have a din derabanan that is there to prevent a malacha from happening, let's say. So that even though one's a derabanan and one's a deraisa, they have different rules, they have different severity, etc., etc., but there seems to be a working assumption that, or at least a possibility, that violating the derabanan is considered like violating the deraisa. That you have, and maybe the idea is that by showing disregard for this deraisa, Chazal said, we're worried about this deraisa, and therefore we want you to stay far away from it, and here's how we want you to stay far away. So failing to worry about that is also an offense against that deraisa. In other words, we're kind of saying that even though you only violated the din derabanan if you neglect whatever shvus we're talking about, but the disregard that you're showing to the deraisa that's trying to protect is significant and means on some level you've done something wrong, which is a fascinating idea to think about, just in terms of even if we say that there is a hierarchy and deraisas and derabanans are on different levels, but the derabanans may perhaps attach themselves to the deraisas that we're talking about. So for example, in the halachas of Yehari Valyavar, which is going to be relevant here as well, so there is a discussion about what we call Abizrayu, and if you have the other prohibitions, lesser prohibitions that are in the category of this din, and sometimes they're going to be prohibitions derabanan. So the question comes up, do we call them Yehari Valyavar or not? So perhaps the idea is that the derabanans are a way of saying, Chazal tell you, this is how much you have to worry about this concept, you have to stay this far away from it. And if you disregard that, at least if you disregard that intentionally, it's an act of disrespect towards the fundamental deraisa that we're talking about, which opens up a whole question about the role of dinam derabanan and the like. Do we say it's one broad concept of observance to Chazal, of not rebelling against the rabbis, or should we say that maybe together with that or instead of that it kind of extends the din deraisa itself? That's something that's interesting to think about. And just also, we'll throw this, also got daf yomi relevance, but while we're talking about the interplay between deraisas and derabanans, so there is a question, I don't know if we've talked about this year or not, if it's come up, but so sometimes you have situations where dinam derabanan redefine the landscape vis-a-vis mitzvos. So, just to throw out a few quick examples, so we've already noted, you don't blow shofar on Shabbos, even though Mina Torah would seem like you have to. In a different type of direction, the Torah has a mitzvah of Berachos HaMazon, but it doesn't seem that all the four brachos that we recite today for Berachos HaMazon are included in that mitzvah deraisa. So Chazal have expanded on the mitzvah. Or let's say Kiddush. We have a mitzvah deraisa to make Kiddush Friday night. Although it's a very big machlokus, one contemporary sefer quoted 15 different views in Poskim as to what is included in the mitzvah deraisa of Zachar Suma Shabbos Lekacho. So in other words, it's very possible that Kiddush Alakos, Kiddush Makom Suda, etc., etc., those are dinam derabanan. So the question always comes up, so what happens if I do the derabanan without the deraisa? All the way around. If I do the deraisa without the derabanan. So let's say I want to make Kiddush Friday night, I just say the words. About Shabbos, I don't make it alakos, I don't make it machum suda. Let's say I bench, I just say the fundamentals of benching, I don't say the four brachos that we have today. Or let's say I blow shofar on Shabbos. So do you say, well, I fulfilled the mitzvah deraisa, I didn't listen to Chazal, but at least I fulfilled the mitzvah deraisa, that is untouched. Or do you say, no, that Chazal came and redefined the mitzvah, and now this is the new rule. This is the new normal. You can't fulfill the mitzvah without following Chazal's view. This has many nafkaminas, by the way. People sometimes think this is only a technical question. It has a lot of ramifications. For example, the major question about whether it's kedai to make kiddush in shul nowadays. If we don't regularly have people eating in the shul, So the question is, why do we still do the practice of making kiddush in shul, which the Gemara says in Pesachim was because of people who were eating in the shul regularly. But now, if you don't necessarily have that arrangement, so why do we make kiddush in shul? So some might say that it's worth making kiddush in shul because maybe there are people there who won't make kiddush otherwise. So let them hear a kiddush there. Now it's going to be lacking. It's not going to be makom suda. So the question is, are you helping them at all? Is it worth anything if you're going to make kiddush shalom makom suda? So if the assumption is, this is a whole detailed discussion, but if the assumption is that daraisu yotzei without makom suda, you're just not yotzei derabanan. So are you accomplishing anything on behalf of these people that they'll hear at least kiddush daraisu? That's something, even if there's no kiddush derabanan. So this question comes up in a lot of cases. Let's say somebody, for example. And again, the Daf Yomi reference, this, by the way, is Machlokis on one level, Tostus in the Ran, and Sukkah Daf Gimel. Take a look over there if you want to pursue this question. But the another example is, let's say somebody takes a lulav the first day of Sukkah, and it's Shabbos that year, so he wasn't supposed to do that. So does he make a Shechiyano the next day like everybody else? Is he performing the mitzvah for the first time? Or do we say, no, he performed the mitzvah yesterday. He wasn't supposed to, but l'maisa he did. So, in general, there's a lot to discuss about how the concepts interact with each other. It's a huge issue with all kinds of details and ripple details. But there are some who are machalik, and it's interesting. I see as far as machalik both ways, but it's noteworthy. There are some who are machalik that maybe it's one thing when you have a mitzvah like kiddush or benching. And Chazal said, the Torah says it's enough this way, but we want you to do more. That's one type of modification. But it's another kind of modification where the Torah says, blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah, and Chazal say, no, don't. We're afraid you're going to violate Nisr, so we're prohibiting you from doing that. Maybe that has a different kind of impact on the Kiyam HaMitzvah. And how the impact plays out, I could see as far to say it both ways. So without going into the specific svaras, but those are two different models. So to hear, these kind of questions might be relevant. Parenthetically, it's also possible there might be a third issue at play, the question of mitzvah hababi avera. Then, if you're not allowed to perform a mitzvah through an avera, what's the relationship of mitzvah deraisa and avera derabanan? What if the avera is midrabanan? So does that passel your mitzvah for that reason, because you did the avera of not listening to Chazal? So there's all kinds of questions one could ask about the interplay between the Darabanans and the Daraisa, and that's perhaps relevant here as well. So it could be on the one hand that the math would never make sense when dealing with one Isser, maybe that's what Kibager is saying. On the other hand, maybe the math could make sense for a couple of reasons, because maybe if we take away the Onesh from the equation, which might be the case here, right, maybe violating a Darabanan, maybe that is the same thing as Ofa. Let's say, for example, if we're trying to prevent afia, and we made a gezeira that's relevant to afia, maybe you might say, you're doing it twice. Right? At first you put the bread in the oven. Now you're doing radiyas apas, which the Rambam says is the gezeira mishum afia, so maybe that means you've just been mosif chet al pesha, you just added another act of disrespect to the prohibition of afia, which reminiscent, we discussed a few days ago, the instinct many people have, unfortunately, if they accidentally turn the light off on Shabbos. So they'll have an instinct to turn it right back on because they want to undo their act, but really that's just a second avera, right? So that's not really going to help. So maybe this is similar, that even though there's such a disparity, one's a deraisa and one's a derabanan, but if they all boil down to, at least in the spirit of what's going on, to a disrespect to the fundamental malacha here, so maybe there is a svar to say, listen, why do this a second time now that you've done it the first time? Okay, so with that in mind, so there is a question here then, what is the fundamental question of the Gemara? Why should the Gemara assume, or at least take as a possibility, that maybe you should not do this drabanan, even if it'll save you from the daraisa? So I left you with a thought experiment yesterday, that there was a suggestion, I think Jonathan made the suggestion, that maybe you'll say that, listen, to do this Rediyas HaPas now, that's a kumbiase, that's an active transgression. And to just leave the bread there, so that's a Shev Al Tasa. So you have a choice between a Shev Al Tasa of leaving the bread there, or a kumbiase of Rediyas HaPas, So maybe the Radias HaPas is worse for that reason. It's worse because it's Kumviyasa.
So I asked you to think about, while there's some attractiveness to that Svara, it may even be right, but there were at least two reasons why the Svara could be undermined. So I asked you to think about what they might be, and one suggestion was that, well, maybe this is not called the Sheva Al-Tasa, because this is all the continuation of your original action of putting it there in the first place. So the Averu will be considered to be an Averu Bekum V'Yaseh, and therefore that's not the right calculus here. What's another possibility? Why else might you say that this is not a perfect type of calculation to say that it's a Sheva Al-Tasa versus a Kum V'Yaseh? So think about it this way. Why is it that we make any such distinction in the first place? Why is it that we say that a Kum V'Yaseh is something we're more scared of than a Sheva Al-Tasa? Why are we assuming that one is better than the other?
Because it has an effect on your psychology, perhaps, more.
Okay. You mean that if you know you're doing something wrong, to do it has a greater impact. You know, basically like the Rambam by Tzedakah. That even if you're giving Tzedakah the same way, it's better to give it out in smaller doses, because every time you do the act of giving Tzedakah, so you are enhancing your Midas Nedivus, you're enhancing your generosity. The Rambam is, by the way, this is in the Perish of Mishnayos to Pirkei Avos, so the Mishnah that says, HaKol Lefi Rov HaMaaseh, the Rambam says, giving tzedakah, better to do it a lot of times, because each time it has an effect on you. So maybe if actions are significant, like the Sefer Achinuch famously said, and Acharei HaPa'ulos, Mshachos HaLevavos, everything you do has an effect on your personality, so a Kum V'Yaseh is going to have more of an impact on you than simply passively letting something pass by. There's truth to that. What else? You know, what else might factor in the difference why we might favor a Sheva Al-Tasa over a Kum V'Yaseh?
Yes. Rabbis are only really willing to be Okerdamer in HaTorah when it's a Sheva Al-Tasa.
Yes. So that's really actually, instead of an answer, that might be the same question. So let's address that question for a second. So first of all, you phrased it in a way that's a little bit interesting, because you said the rabbi is only willing to be Oker v'Sheva Al-Tasa. So the question is it a question about willing, or is it a question about what's even possible? So what Ari is referring to is the Gemara of Masechet Yevamos and Daf Tzadi Tes and Daf Peites and Daf Tzadi, Daf Peites and Daf Tzadi, where there the Gemara has the famous sugya of Yesh Koach Laker Davar Menat Torah v'Sheva Al-Tasa, that there is authority, there is power given to Chazal to uproot a mitzvah d'oraisa. Let's use again the famous example of not blowing shofar on Rosh Hashanah Shechalios B'Shabbos. But the condition the Gemara has, even though it's a back and forth in the Gemara, there is an opinion that it could be done b'kum v'yaseh, but the way we assume is that it is b'sheva al-tasa, that only if it's, let's say, passive, but not active. So, for example, Chazal aren't going to tell us to be treif. Chazal aren't going to tell us to be mechal Shabbos, as we discuss here. What Chazal generally do is they tell us, don't blow shofar, don't take lulav, etc., etc. Don't wear tzitzis with shatnez, which is minat Torah, what we would have done otherwise. Chazal tell us not to do things that we should otherwise do, but they don't tell us to do something that would have been wrong. So, there is a lot to discuss about that. There is a famous essay, a very beautiful essay. He used to say you could inspire someone to become a Baal Tshuva with this essay, because the Lamdas is so beautiful, so inspiring. So the Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, in his Kovetz Ha'aris on Yevamos, on that Gemara, has a piece which is also printed in the Kovetz Shiurim. Rabbi Chanan has the Kovetz Shiurim on a few Masechtas, and the Kovetz Ha'aris on Yevamos. I'm not sure who decided the titles, because the Kovei Tzaharis is full of very intricate, lengthy shiurim, and the Kovei Shiurim is filled with haris. So I don't know who decided the title, maybe the same guy who decided that you park in a driveway and drive in a parkway. But in both places, so in the Kovei Tzaharis, he has this whole essay, and in the Kovei Shiurim, so there is a section called Kuntres Divrei Sofra, where he has a few essays about the Koach of Chazal and how it works, and that whole story. So he has that essay in both places.
So he asks this question. So why is it that we make this distinction? If we're going to give Chazal the authority to overrule the Torah, so why is it that we make the distinction between Sheval Tase and Kumbiase? So he assumes that there are two possible reasons, and neither of which we've actually said so far today. So what are the two possible reasons? And they tie in, as he beautifully explains, to a question I mentioned a few minutes ago. Let's say I do blow shofar on Shabbos. Did I fulfill a mitzvah? Is the mitzvah still there? Or do we say, no, that Chazal really, as the Gemara sounds like, they were oker the mitzvah. There is no longer any kiyum mitzvah in blowing shofar on Shabbos. Essentially, Chazal have the authority to kind of rewrite the Torah. So, consistent with those two explanations, he suggests the following. You could say, let's say you assume for a second that Chazal are not oker the mitzvah. The mitzvah is still there. But Chazal have the ability to tell you not to do it. There is still a mitzvah to blow shofar on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, no matter what day of the week it is. But Chazal have the authority to say don't, and the chiddush is we have to listen to them. We observe, you know, their command, and we don't blow shofar on Shabbos, even though there is still a mitzvah on the books to do so. So if that's what's going on, then you could say that the reason we say Sheva Al Tase is preferable, it's because really we have basically a conflict. We're between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, you have the Torah telling us, blow shofar. On the other hand, you have Chazal saying, don't you dare blow that shofar. So what do? How do you reconcile two conflicting instructions? So you can't if they really conflict, but we sometimes advise people with other issues in life, we sometimes say, sheval taisa adif, that if you're passive, at least you're not getting in anyone's face. At least you're not doing something blatantly against what somebody says. We assume that omission is less offensive than commission. So if you just happen not to be doing what somebody asks, that's less offensive to them than if you actively do what they tell you not to do. So since you can't reconcile this conflict, the Torah is saying do it, and the rabbis are saying don't do it, we'll stay at it. We're just not going to do anything. And obviously we're not really making the Torah happy that way, but at least we're not actively contradicting the Torah. So in that explanation, the whole chiluk between Sheva Al-Tase and Kumziase, it's really just a strategic chiluk. It just has to do with the fact that it's good advice to stay out of this conflict zone and act passively, and to not inflame anybody too much by doing something that's visible and active. And if that's the case, as Rabbi Chanan points out, then you see, how do you define what's considered to be Sheva Al Tase or Kumbi Ase, if sometimes it's a complicated definition? Right, Lo Samud Al Dam Riacha. Is that an Ase or a Lo Sase? You know, on the one hand, you violate it passively, just by sitting on your hands, by doing nothing. On the other hand, it's phrased in the Torah as a Lav. So, which is it? So, says Rabbi Chanan, if you're talking like this, then it's essentially all behavior-based. Nothing to do with the language that we use. It's all about, physically speaking, are you doing something or are you not doing something? However, you could define it differently. You could say that it's really about mitzvah sase versus mitzvah lo sase. And that the issue is that it's all about severity. That we have an assumption that los aseis are more severe averos than not doing mitzvah aseis, than bittul aseis. And there is a lot of support for that assumption. What's the support for that assumption? Onshin. Right? If we assume that onshin reflects something about the chumra of the avera, that a chi of kares is a more severe avera than a chi of malchus, so bittul aseis generally doesn't have any onish, for the most part. So, if you use that as your measuring stick, which is reasonable, then it comes out that all the los assays, for the most part, are more chomer than all the assays. So that would be an afkamina, right? Then maybe mila would actually take on a different status, that even though it's sheival tase in terms of behavior, but maybe we should treat it like an aver. Which, but I think it's Fasemis has a comment like this, that could answer a Tosfos. Tosfos has a question, why does the Gemara need a pasuk
to say that women are putter from giving a bris mila to their sons. Why don't we say that it's a mitzvah sasei shazman grama, so women are putter. So I think the Sfasema suggests that you could say that we treat it like it's a lav. Right?
Isn't because, it a mitzvah sasei shazman grama?
So the assumption, that's a whole different topic, which we'll get into. The assumption is that since you can't do it at night, and since you can't do it before the eighth day, cannot do it. Nobody's still good at bris mila at night. Apparently, ridiculously early in the morning is okay, but night is no good. So that's an exclusion, and it can't be before the eighth day. So let's say for those reasons, they show us mangram. But that's very off topic. But the point is that you see there that maybe it's treated like a lo sase, even though it's an ase. Or we mentioned the other day the whole question of why did Chazal not make a gezeira that you shouldn't do a bris mila on Shabbos? That if they said don't blow shofar, take a lulav on Shabbos, why don't they say also don't do a bris mila on Shabbos? We mentioned one answer the other day, but you could also say that bris mila is considered like a lo sase, that even though it's active, but if it involves an onesh, maybe all onshin are treated like lo sases.
I mean, like the Tosos and Rabbi Lazar, doesn't seem like that because he keeps asking like, why would you take an interest in Rabbin? Maybe you get an
assay
and a lotase at the same time. Don't violate that lotase, right? So he's obviously assuming that
versus
not.
It's treated like an assay.
Yeah.
Right. And then, man, that's what you would think. Yeah. But maybe it would answer some questions to say that it's treated like a lotase because of the onesh, or at least for some purposes. Maybe so, for example, for the idea of akiras davar min haTorah, for this specific idea, if it's all the whole distinction is based on onesh or no onesh, maybe that's going to be relevant. Right.
It seems like for Shabbos Yisrael, particular, mm-hmm.
Well, it depends. Maybe this case you could. And maybe this case exactly was such an example. They have Malach Moshevus when you put it in.
Well, that was doing something.
Right, but so now the question is, so really, essentially, this might be the question in the Gemara, right? That maybe the issue is, so if Chazal are going to tell you to leave it in the oven, so maybe we'll compare this to Chazal saying, don't blow shofar on Shabbos, something like that. It's an example of them insisting on their rules, even in the face of a greater Torah principle, or a seemingly greater Torah principle. So then what are the rules? Well, in that case, we have a rule that we distinguish between Shevi Altas and Kum V'Yase. So maybe the question is, what would we consider this? Leaving it in the oven, would that be considered a Shevi Altas because it's passive? Or should we say, no, but it invokes an onesh. And the whole distinction is only relevant because it means there's no onesh. But once there's an onesh, maybe this distinction between Kum V'Yase and Shevi Altas is no longer relevant. So theoretically, that could have been the question. Hi.
Even if you say it like that, the point of the chiluk was that you have worse ownership. So you wouldn't say that Radias Apostia would get you skila.
Right. But the whole other assumption that's exactly the point, that if you say that the onish is the defining factor,
right,
then you would say for sure take it out. The question is, what are the two studs? So if you say that it's all about passive behavior, we're not paying attention to onesh or no onesh, so maybe we should say, like you suggested, leave it in, because at least that's passive, rather than taking it out. But if the whole distinction is only because there's a presumption that it's less punishable,
right,
so if this is going to leave you with a bigger punishment, then the distinction doesn't follow, and therefore take it out.
Oh, okay.
That maybe that's the suffix in the Gemara. That's a possible issue. Hi.
According to the, I think it was the Rashash who says it's Al-Tanai.
The Zriya and the Bishul, right.
The Bishul. So how would that work with this? If it's not Sheva Al-Tasa, once it's already done, it goes back to the Malacha itself. That's what you actually did.
Well, it may be the same kind of idea that maybe he would also say, and there's other aspects here we have to figure out about that, but maybe again, that taka wouldn't be really a Sheva Al-Tasa. Or maybe that's another way of saying the suffix in the Gemara. That maybe the Gemara is, what's the malacha of Bishul? Is the malacha letting it get to its finish line? Or is the malacha putting it there in the first place, al tanai? So maybe we'll say that the tanai is not such a focus. Hi.
I didn't get that. So we're trying to figure out why Shev al tasa is better than...
If that's the assumption, there's a couple steps here. But the question is, why does the Gemara even think that, even if that's not the conclusion, but why is it even a possibility that we would tell you, leave this in the oven rather than take it out. If mathematically it's so illogical, you'll get a bigger aver for leaving it in, so then for sure do that. So one suggestion that was on the table is that, well, maybe Sheva Al Tasa is better than Kuvyase. So better to not violate Rediyas HaPas than to actively violate it when you would have otherwise passively violated a malacha. So the question is that accurate breakdown? Is it really going to be considered Sheva Al Tasa? Maybe not. If Sheva Al Tasa, it goes back to the original Maisa, that's one reason to say maybe not. Or also, if Sheva Al Tasa is only significant because it normally indicates less than an Onesh, so here that's not necessarily true, so it's not going to maybe be relevant for that reason.
So,
that in general, if in general what we mean by Sheva Al Tasa, let's say when we talk about Yesh Koach, Akadav Matar of Sheva Al Tasa, then maybe what we usually mean is that, yeah, Chazal can tell you not to blow shofar or take lulav, because there's no onesh involved. So that shows you that they're less chomer, and that Chazal's power is just quantitatively limited. They're able to take on a non-onesh concept. But a concept that involves an onesh, like a active transgression, they can't take on such a concept. So if that's the relevant distinction, so here this wouldn't be called Sheva Al Tasa, this would be called Kuvyase, because it connects to an onesh. And so this is, in general, a question that comes up by all these things. By the way, just to you, know, a little bit of a Shas Sugi moment, so just to know this general chiluk between Sheva Al Tasa and Kuvyase, which involves a question of definition, you know, what do we mean by it? Do we mean mitzvah saseh versus lo saseh, or are we talking about behavior? So just if your comprehensivity should know that at least three places in halacha that question comes up. The distinction is relevant. If it's not relevant here, it's relevant in at least three other places. So what are they? So one is what we just talked about now, Yesh Koach. What are the other two? So we talked about this, I guess, 2 years ago when learning Shabbos. Kavod HaBrios. Right? The Gemara says that Kavod HaBrios outweighs certain halachic values. And one of them is when the other value is Sheva Al Tasa. That Kavod HaBrios can sometimes allow you, let's say, to skip out on a mitzvah. So, in that case also, you have the Achron, the stipler about Kavod HaBrios and Masechta Shavuos, where he has this discussion. And every time the discussion comes up, the Achronim ask, so what do we mean by Sheva Al Tasa? Are we talking about mitzvah saseh versus lo saseh, or are we talking about passive versus active behavior? And the third area of halacha is not from the Gemara, it's from a little bit later, it's really from the Ramah, that, as we discussed, the Ramah is a major source of halacha too, that the question of Hamavazvez, Al Yavazvez, Yosem Michomesh, that the Gemara says that when one's giving tzedakah, there's a limit to how much tzedakah you should give because we're afraid that you might become impoverished yourself. So the Gemara says that, normally speaking, Gemara in Ksubas and Daf Nun, that you should not give more than a fifth of your money away to tzedakah. So the Ramah in Hilchos Lulav, the Ramah adds two chidushim to this din. Says one is that this is not just about tzedakah, it's about mitzvos. So if your lulav costs you more than a fifth, you don't have to buy the lulav. And that even though it's true about mitzvos, it's only true about mitzvah saseh. But a mitzvah lo saseh, then we say that one has to give up kol hon beiso. One has to give up all his money rather than violate a lo saseh. Now the Ramah was very authoritative. Like we said, there were those who disagreed. There were those who did not acknowledge such a chiluk, but this, the Vilna-Gaon perhaps, it's a little bit of a machlokus, but the Ramah has been very influential on this point, so that there is a distinction between assays and los assays as far as that's concerned. So these three areas of halacha, you have a distinction like this, and in each case, you have the poskim trying to figure out, how do we define the term? What's the real dividing line? Is the dividing line between what is active or passive, or is it about chumras ha'avera, so it's about onshin, things like that? So that could be the question here. That could have been the question here. Rav Asher Weiss, in one of his essays in Masechta Shabbos, so he considers that possibility. So ultimately, he doesn't think that that's really true, because you don't find that the Rishonim connect this at all to Yesh Koach, Lachar Davar Min HaTorah, And to pounce on Arya's language before about willing, what Chazal are willing to do. So it also doesn't sound like that's the deen in the Gemara. The Gemara doesn't seem to be wondering about Chazal's authority as much as what are we telling you to do, which is a little bit of a question still. Are we talking about the Ikar Adin? Are we talking about advice? Are we talking about practice? But it doesn't seem like the issue in the Gemara is really halachic authority of Chazal. So while that might have been what's going on, he's not so convinced.
I mean, they are Chazal. In the discussion in the Gemara, so they wouldn't be arguing their own.
Well, you do when you're Vamos. You know, yeah, I don't know if that's necessarily exclusive. But that could have theoretically been the issue here, but it doesn't seem like it. Now, yes, so that point is well taken, but again, there's a couple of different nuances here. So the general question of whether there is a kumviase sheval tasa suffik here, and whether that's the back and forth, you know, might still be possible, even if you are not willing to necessarily connect it to that other sugya. So, what's another possibility? What else might be the question here? So, another possibility that he discusses, and that the Rishonim discuss, so for example, I don't remember if I put the Tosfos Rishonim, I don't think I did, on the Mar Makomos, but you should look at Tosfos Rishonim here on the daf, it's on the side of the page. But remember, we did mention, we talked about this in a different way a few days ago, that Tosfos makes the assumption. Tosfos says, what's the whole question? If we're going to tell somebody to incur a chi of Misa, to observe a din derabanan, he's not going to listen to us anyway. So asks Tosfos, what exactly is the Gemara's question? Which is a fascinating assumption, right, that he's not going to listen to us anyway, because it's possible that he will, but Sfas Emes over here objects, what do you mean he's not going to listen? So, Milanoshach, we have a concept called Yehari Vayavur, which means we do sometimes tell people to put themselves in those situations for the sake of halacha. Now, maybe he'll listen, maybe he won't listen, but we don't say in those sugyas that, well, they're not going to listen, so let's not talk about it. So why don't we say that that's a worthwhile discussion, and that's really the crux of it. The crux of it is this a din where you're told to take that kind of a gamble, but not necessarily the concern of whether they'll listen or they won't listen. So there's a what to talk about that. In a different piece, Rav Asher Weiss considers the question that maybe there's a whole different angle here, that maybe the halacha is one thing, but then maybe it becomes a pikuach nefesh shayla afterwards. That maybe you could say that, all right, the din was that whether it's for you or for somebody else, if you got to stay there. Oh, but now somebody's looking at a chi of misa, so now maybe there is a pikuach nefesh docha Shabbos consideration. Maybe that's what's going on.
It's very far removed.
Right, that's a creative possibility. But it's interesting because the question does come up. Do we say that if you could save somebody from a chi of misa, just do we look at it from that perspective, as a pikuach nefesh perspective, separately from the halachic considerations? But that also involves another central question here, that are we talking about preventing averus, or are we talking about preventing onshin, or are there two separate tracks? Maybe I'm not justified preventing the avera, but then maybe I can ask a separate question, am I justified taking action to prevent the onish, looked at by itself? Hi.
If you subscribe to such a concept, that means anytime someone's on trial for chai mis, they should, you know, try and punch out the beis din and run away.
Well, punch out the beis din would seem to be a little bit of much, but that's hard to say that that's the right thing to do. But it is interesting. The Minchas Elazar has a truth about this, that if somebody himself is done with misa, the guy's a Zionist, so he's chai misa. So those listening to tape, that was a joke. The Minchas Elazar will be able to say that. But the question, the Kadjib Lever has an essay about this also, so he'll say it differently. But the question of is somebody who, the interesting question of the mitzvah, v'yarta rel mikirbecha, is that a mitzvah on Klal Yisrael, or is that a mitzvah on the individual? And would you go so far as to say, so it's a mitzvah on the defendant also. So he has a chiyuv, if he's dam l'misa, he has a chiyuv not to run away. Is there anything wrong with him running away if he sees that there's a crack in the door and he could escape? So is he? It's also for him to do that, or do we say, you know, go for it? You do what you do. We have to do what we have to do. You have to do what you have to do. So there is such a discussion. But punch out the beis din would be certainly a little bit much. But you're right. The question is, so where do we draw the line? And if you have the ability, it's like he discusses also. So let's say you were madir somebody from your food. Right, so you took a neder that the food is off limits to somebody else. So if you see he's about to eat it, so should we say, okay, so now you should quickly mati your neder so he won't be in violation of this sister? Yeah, do we ever say things like that? It's interesting we talk about Lifnei Iver, so there's a lot of parallel issues here. So do we say that we're focused, is really the same question to a certain extent, the Lifnei Iver question, right? The Tut Zdadim about whether it's a Ben Adam L'Chaver or a Ben Adam L'Makom, which maybe we'll come back to when we talk about the other aspect of this. But in any event, so this is that was all just a tangent on this Tosis. But Tosis says, so what about the fact that he's not going to listen? So Tiretz Riva, right, this line which we mentioned a whole different angle on a few days ago, Tiretz Riva, the imlo hitiro lo mechayiv skivla, kevin shemeniach melirdos al yidei masha anu osrin lo. Basically, he's going to say that the person is not going to be chayiv skivla no matter what. And we mentioned a creative explanation from the Kajib level the other day that it's about the reason why Bezdin doesn't accept tshuva. But the simple level of Tosfos, what's Tosfos saying? That why is he not going to be chayiv skila? What's the reason? Right. He's saying that that has to be the case, otherwise this whole discussion is hard to imagine. But technically, why should it be? Because what can this guy claim if you want to come and prosecute him? What can he claim? I'm an honest. I had no choice. I would have stopped it. I would have saved the aver from happening. But I was prohibited to by Chazal, so that makes me an onus. Now, there is such a concept called onus betakanas chachamim, which is explicit in the Gemara in the beginning of Ksubis. Right, that's a little bit of a preview for next year, although next year she was on the third paragraph, the first paragraph. But in the first paragraph of Ksubis, so there is a Gemara which talks about, in terms of conditions, ben adam l'chaveru. But the point is that when somebody has an obligation to somebody else, so if he is prohibited, if he's prevented physically from fulfilling the condition, so he might be off the hook if he's an onus. And it's clear from the Gemara there that if the onus is not because there was any physical impediment, but Chazal said that he can't, in that case, get married yet, so then that's also onus. Onus b'takanas chachamim. The person is unavoidably prevented because he's following Chazal. As Reb Moshe said, halacha is like a brick wall. He's prevented from doing it. He doesn't have a choice. This, by the way, is one of the key factors. I'm sure you've heard about the fascinating question that the Achronim ask about Yom Kippur and Tzom Gedalia. The question is, let's say you go to the doctor to get your physical checkup to see whether you're healthy enough to fast. So you go before Rosh Hashanah to the doctor to see if you'll be able to fast in the upcoming fast. So the doctor knows a little bit about halacha. He doesn't know that much. So he says, yeah, you have Yom Kippur coming up. Yeah, I think you're healthy enough to make it through Yom Kippur. I wouldn't fast twice in a week, but Yom Kippur, you should be able, it's only once a year, you should be able to manage it. In other words, he doesn't know about Tzom Gedalia. So what he's basically saying is you can only fast one day in the upcoming month. So what should you do? Should you do Yom Kippur? Because Yom Kippur is clearly a much bigger deal than Tzom Gedalia. Or do you say, no, that Tzom Gedalia comes first. And you take your halachic responsibilities one at a time. So the halacha is, you have to fast on Tzom Gedalia. The doctor said you're able to fast, so you're not too sick to fast. And then, when Yom Kippur comes, come what may. So essentially, what's that side? It's the that side seems very hard to swallow, because Yom Kippur, in a sense, this really is somewhat similar to this whole discussion here. Yom Kippur is so obviously a bigger deal than Tzom Gedalia, if we're simply ranking what's a more important halachic principle. So Yom Kippur is clearly ranked so much higher than Tzom Gedalia, especially Bizman Azeth, and clear the nature of some of these Taneisim. So Yom Kippur is certainly a much bigger obligation. So why would you say that you should trade Yom Kippur for Tzom Gedalia? So on one hand, it really does seem to have some kind of overlap with this sugya. Do we say that, listen, you follow Chazal's dictates without the cheshbainis, even if that's what it means? But part of the mechanics there is that you, when it comes time to Yom Kippur, you're off the hook because you can't fast on Yom Kippur because you're an onus. Because if the doctor said that you're not healthy enough, so you're an onus, you're potter. Now you might say, what do you mean I'm an onus? So if I decide, Erev Yom Kippur, I'm going to go on a ski trip all day, or I'm going to go walking up a mountain until minutes before Yom Kippur, and then comes Yom Kippur and I'm going to be exhausted and potting and dehydrated, so I'm going to have to eat. So no one would say that that's a correct decision. Right? What right do you have to put yourself in that position where you're not going to be able to fast? Presumably, we would never tell somebody to do something like that without a mitzvah. So apparently the understanding there is, again, that if that's what happens, so you're an honest, but Takanas Chachamim. Chazal told you to fast on some Gedalia, that's the Takanas Chachamim. The fast means you're not healthy enough on Yom Kippur. Okay, so you're honest, as if you were stam sick. And the fact that you're listening to Chazal, that's recognized as an honest. So to hear, maybe that's what's going on. And that will say that since you're honest, al pi Takanas Chachamim, so therefore, there is no ownership anyway, so it's as if you're not doing anything wrong by leaving the sin. So maybe that's the suffix in the Gemara. And maybe the Gemara suffix simply is that if you're going to follow through on what the halacha asks here, if the halacha really is that you should just leave it there, so then once that happens, you're no longer doing anything wrong. So then that's what changes the math. It's not a deraisa versus a derabanan, it becomes a no issur at all. So that's another possibility. There also, Vasher Weiss considers and dismisses it because he doesn't think that that's really also supported by the Rishonim and the other things, even though in this case it really is suggested by some of the Rishonim, but it also doesn't necessarily fit into everything. But that's interesting because there's all kinds of implications here. First of all, are we just concerned about, if you say to do an Aveira Ba'onis, is that really nothing? Is that really just because you're not going to be punishable at all, so therefore we're not worried about it anymore? Or it brings up that question again, that what is it that we're trying to save you from with the Bishul here? Are we trying to save you from the Aveira, or are we trying to save you from the Onesh? Or is the Onesh indicative of an Aveira? Or how do we look at it? So, and where is the Aveira? Is the Aveira leaving it in? Is the Aveira putting it there in the first place? All of these questions are brought up by that again. So perhaps that's the issue. If this is the issue, so then it really would seem to be very different for yourself versus for another person. That this cheshbon might make sense for you yourself, but for another person, this logic isn't going to apply at all, because you're doing the right thing, but his aver is still just as strong. So even if you yourself might have such an excuse, if you put it in, then you're listening to Tekanas Chachamim, then that definitely will make the two halves of the sugya completely separate from each other. One of the reasons that Rav Asher Weiss and others question this is because the Rambam paskins that this applies even if you put it in Bishogeg. And the Rambam scenario that you put it in Bishogeg, I mean, you remember in the middle, so it's Chilasa Bishogeg V'sofa V'mezid, you wouldn't be Chayiv a Karban anyway. So that doesn't seem to be the issue, whether you're going to be Chayiv or Pater, or what exactly is going on. The Meiri disagrees. The Meiri says that when he comes to Shogeg, the issue is, are you actually going to be Chayiv a Karban or not? Which is another interesting question. We'll have to come to this. There's too much interesting stuff in this sugya. All right, so just to quickly rush through a few more points, then we'll have still some left over. We have to talk about on behalf of others. That's still that major sugya learning in the background. But the possibility he ultimately does like is that essentially the Gemara is asking a question, which we've alluded to this already, that what's really worse here? So you have a choice between two things. That leaving this in, that's going to be some type of an aver. It's going to incur an onesh, something wrong. Clearly, if there was no Shabbos considerations, we would say it's wrong to leave this in. So how wrong is it?
What do you mean no Shabbos?
Let's say if there was no issur taking it out of the oven. Let's say, for example, we're talking about bishul, or something on the oven rather than something on the stove rather than something in the oven. Right, so we're not talking about Radia Sapas. We're talking about some other Aveira you could stop in the middle. So what exactly... So let's say there's something wrong then with not doing this. You have the ability to stop your Aveira in the middle. There's something wrong with not doing that. How wrong is it? Meaning, how is the blame apportioned here? Is it that really the whole Aveira was putting it there in the first place, and just leaving it there is the cherry on the ice cream? Or do you say, no, that really the aver is this whole process, and you've really got a whole lot left here, and if you go through with it, that's where you're really doing something wrong. And that maybe that's essentially the Gemara's question, that what really is the machayev here? Is the machayev putting it in, or is the machayev leaving it in? And if the machayev is putting it in, and leaving it in is just... an extra patch that you're so mechutzah that you could have stopped it and you don't, So, okay, so if Chazal say you're not allowed to, so then that logic doesn't apply. But if that's the real Aveira, letting it stay there, so then it takes on a whole different Chumrah, and that maybe that outweighs the idea of taking it out. Now, he doesn't say this, but I would think that this would correlate very well, again, to our whole discussion that runs through every sugi we've had so far, about, especially when we come at it from a Shabbos perspective. Right? Then when we come at it from a Shabbos perspective, it would seem that maybe there's a bigger case to say that the whole Aveira is in disturbing your rest, in your Maisa Malacha, and that even if technically there's only going to be a Chiyuv when it follows through, but the Aveira has really happened already. The disturbing of your rest has really taken place. And if we say that normally somebody who intentionally puts something in the oven and leaves it there has been Mechal Shabbos. So if it's possible to stop it by taking it out, so that initial Maisa that was Mechayev him is still there. So especially when it comes to Shabbos, it's very likely to say that you can't really undo the Aveira per se. It's just you have the ability to stop yourself from the onesh, to save yourself from the, or save yourself or someone else from the onesh. And the question the Gemara has is, how valuable is that? How valuable is that in light of the fact that the Aveira really has taken place already? So perhaps especially when it comes to Shabbos, this is a more pressing question because of that structure of how Chilul Shabbos is understood. Hi.
If we say it like this, then what's the tzad at all to let him undo it? Financial loss in the Korban Chatas?
What's the tzad that what?
Maybe not financial loss, but maybe that the
Chiyuv itself is something that we want to avoid. That the Chiyuv in general, Onshin connect to Chiyuv, like we said before, that maybe Onshin
is...
It's
the Chiyuv of Onshin.
Right, but that means something. That means that something has come to fruition, and that maybe that is the question. You know, maybe
it's not to see your spark.
Right, that maybe the side to say not to do it is because you believe that it's all front-loaded in that initial putting it in, and that you're not really accomplishing so much by taking it out. So maybe that's essentially the Gemara Safek about how exactly does this play out. Now clearly, just to emphasize how Shabbos would be different from other things, so let's say, for example, when it comes to Nezikin, right? So we've discussed in the past, if somebody sets a fire, and a half hour later, that fire burns down a house. So you're liable for that. That's one of the avos Nezikin. And you're liable from the time that you set the fire. So still, no one would say that, let's say, again, it's not a Shabbos issue, it's for simplicity. Let's say on a Tuesday, so you set a fire at 3 o'clock, and you see that it's spreading, and you see that if you don't do anything right now, by 4 o'clock it's going to burn down the house. So would you say, well, you know, I really could take the fire extinguisher now, but there's no point, because I already did the Maisa Aveira, and I'm going to be guilty anyway, so there's no point in my stopping the fire. Right? In that case, it's clear there's a point in doing it. You know, that clear that that is defined by its final impact. And nobody would say that makes any sense to say, well, I've already done my part, so I'm not going to accomplish anything by stopping it. So there does seem to be room to say there's different kinds of Averis, Averis that are more impact-oriented, and Averis that are more about the initial action, and maybe this is really more of a Shabbos Suffolk than it is an Avera in general Suffolk. So that's a possible issue here as well. He discusses, just to round it out, just mention this last point, and then the whole sugya of on behalf of others, that'll be our last part for next time. But the question of what would you say if the Chassam Sofer has a suffix about this, that if a malacha has to be a tikkun, so let's say you cook food because the food is going to be edible and valuable when it's cooked, so would it help at all if you're going to leave something in the oven so long that past its takeout time, so that it's going to shrivel up and be inedible? So is that neitzah? Does that save you from the initial bishul? That rhymes. Does that save you from the initial cooking? That if you leave it in the oven so long that it's no longer any kind of a tikkun, that you're no longer chayiv? Hi.
Because at a certain point it got to an edible object, so then you would be chayiv, and then after that, so it was destroyed. But at a certain point, one split second or split 20 minutes,
even though it wasn't accessible,
right?
But we do have a concept of like a kalkel that you can be doing in Israel all the way till its destruction.
You're saying that if Mekalkel is Pater, so we never ever heard anyone say that, well, it depends. What if it's Mekalkel at the end, but in the middle you happen to leave it in a worthwhile state, so then maybe you're chayiv for the in-between. It always goes based on... So that's probably true, right? So let's say if you had this plan to begin with, let's say you decided you want to destroy this piece of flour, so you're going to put it in the oven and leave it there until it disappears. So would that be a chiyuv afiyah? Probably not. Although that's, I saw once in the Tshuvas Yad Sofer that he thought that that was totally on where we learn Bishul from. We learn it from the Mishkan, and we learn it from the creating of the Mishkan, and the making of the Mishkan. But presumably not. Presumably that if you're doing the act of Bishul, but your intent is to keep going with it until it's no longer usable, I'm not clear that that would be the Malacha. Hi.
So if you were to have, let's say, a flour, like a ground flour, not the baking flour, and it needs water right now, but when you overwater, you're going to drown it. So while you're still doing good for that wouldn't be Zriya because it's...
Maybe, yeah, if your intent is to... if your intention is to drown it, maybe so. Right, if you come with a whole bucket of water and you plan on dumping it on the plant, it's probably true as far as the chiyuv d'oraisa. It probably is not true. Yeah. Especially actually in that example, because we only come on to watering plants as a malacha because of its result. If it never has any result, and especially in Zriya, because you know you need some time for it to act out. There's no such thing as giving it water and having it be automatically beneficial. It's beneficial because it contributes to growth. Doing it in such a way that it's never going to have any time
right,
to...
Right, there you know you're going to be...
Right. So even that example, I'd say all the more so, but still. So that's a discussion that you could possibly bring a raya from here, that at least after the fact it doesn't help, because that would be an easy etzah for this guy, so that maybe we don't let you take it out. Maybe we'll say, all right, so you can't take it out, but then I have a better plan, I'll just leave it there until it's no longer edible, and it won't be chayiv that way. So the fact that that doesn't seem to be a possibility here, maybe that says something about this. Okay, so I have to check our schedule. Tomorrow we have Parsha Pekudei and Parsha Shkolim, so we'll talk a little bit about those things. So next week we have to finish this, and then get to the Rishuyos, and then get to the midterms. So I have to figure out whether we'll do this on Sunday.